From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. About a decade ago, controversy was stirring up in Great Britain over whether the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine was causing autism in young children. A study published in a British medical journal allegedly proving this was debunked during a series of investigative reports by journalist Brian Deer for the Sunday Times of London. Deer spoke last month at UW La Crosse, and I talked with him during his visit.
The most recent round of controversy over vaccines began in the UK in the late 1990s with publication of a paper in a medical journal called The Lancet, a very influential medical journal. I think it's reckoned to be number three after the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association. So it's an influential journal. It published a paper by a doctor called Andrew Wakefield and a group of other doctors. It was basically by him, but there were 12 other names on the paper, a 4,000-word, five-page paper, which suggested that he'd found an apparent link between the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps and rubella triple vaccine, and the development of what he was calling regressive autism. And he published a paper in The Lancet based on reports on 12 children. And it described MMR as the apparent precipitating event for the development of regressive autism in 8 of these 12 children.
And essentially he had said that having those three vaccines together was part of the cause.
Ultimately, it was never clear as to what he was saying was the cause, but he did say at the time the paper was published that he thought that having the vaccines given to children separately, separated by a period of a year, so you'd have one vaccine and then a year later you'd have a vaccine for another component and then another year. He said he thought that would be safer, but given that he was a gut surgeon, it's difficult to know what he would have to say about that because he wasn't a paediatrician. He has never had a patient in his life. He wasn't a specialist in any relevant area. He was a former trainee gut surgeon doing research into inflammatory bowel disease. So what he would know about these things, God only knows. But yes, he said this. He got himself media coverage saying this and triggered widespread public concern among parents in particular that somehow there was a link between vaccines and autism.
And in your investigation, you found there was a bit of a backstory to Mr. Wakefield
and this research.
It
kind of unfolded. It was like peeling, I think it was my lawyers in Dallas who put it in these terms, that it was like peeling an onion. We started off by discovering that the children in the research weren't just children turning up at a hospital. I mean, when you think about it, if a dozen families turned up at a hospital and the parents all said, well, we gave our child the MMR vaccine and within weeks we saw the first signs of autism. The paper actually said this, that within 14 days, 8 out of 12 of these kids were showing what was described as the first behavioural symptoms of autism. Now, if that was right and this was just parents turning up at one really undistinguished hospital. The work was done at a North London hospital called the Royal Free, a completely uninteresting hospital, not a major centre for anything. If it was true that parents were turning up and saying these things, then you would want to put it on television and have, because they might be seeing the first snapshot of what could be a hidden epidemic of injuries being caused by vaccines. So at face value, you'd think, well, that's very serious. But what we then discovered was that these 12 families were in it together. They were a group that had been put together from anti-vaccine campaigners for the purpose of advancing a lawsuit. So there were a group, we discovered that two of the children were brothers, three of them were seen at the same hospital, two came from the same doctor's office, hundreds of miles from the hospital. None of the children came from London. So we discovered that this was a group of families who'd come to make this allegation, and we discovered that it had been funded for litigation by a UK government agency which finances litigation which allows ordinary people to sue. So that was the first thing we discovered, that Wakefield had a very serious conflict of interest, because when he said that the vaccine may be causing autism, what he didn't say was that he was being paid to make this allegation. In fact, we discovered that he was being paid £150, which I suppose these days, I don't know how that would work out into dollars. I think it's probably, these days, it would probably be about $300, $350 an hour to support this lawsuit, so that if he stood up at a press conference and said that the vaccine may cause autism, he would continue to get that money on an hourly basis. But if he said anything else, the money would stop. So he had a very serious conflict of interest. So that was the first thing we discovered. And then in due course, we discovered how much money he'd received. I think it was, we worked it out, it was $750,000 he'd received to make these allegations. And then we discovered that, in fact, the actual data in the paper itself had been rigged. The paper itself was not true. His theory was, and this is where it becomes a bit odd about why three vaccines together would make any difference, his theory was that it was the measles component in the vaccine that was causing the problem, was the ultimate culprit was measles virus. And I made a television program in 2004 when I was young and summers were warmer and seems a long time ago now, 2004. Made a TV show where we found the researcher from Wakefield's own lab who'd done this work, and he hadn't found measles virus in any of these children. So that was the second phase. And then the third phase was when we established that that the paper was just simply false.
So in the fallout from the investigation, the Lancet ended up retracting Mr. Wakefield's study.
Yeah.
And he's no longer a doctor, is that correct?
He's had his license to practice medicine withdrawn. He suffered journalistically, I suppose, in the court of public opinion. But then in 2007, I think he was very seriously damaged in Washington when the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, Vaccine Court, held test case hearings on his theories relating to like 5,000 claimant families, and the verdicts against him were just excoriating, and doctors who had given evidence in support of children, giving evidence saying that some children had been vaccine damaged, coming to the court and accusing him of fraud. So he was very seriously damaged there. And then last year, the British Medical Journal's editors described his work as an elaborate fraud.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Brian Deer. He's an investigative journalist known for his work with the Sunday Times of London. He's visiting the UW La Crosse campus, giving a talk called An Elaborate Fraud, the MMR Vaccine and Autism. Our next question comes from Pauline Lee with News 8 in La Crosse.
Hi, my question to you is, this was a general assignment that you thought was going to take 3 weeks. Did you think it would spread this quickly, that would change kind of the course of the way people think about vaccines?
Well, when you say it would change the way people thought, I'm not sure that it has changed the way people have thought, because the overwhelming majority of people do what I think must be the right thing and talk to their doctors. There is a small number of people who maintain the argument that vaccines and autism are linked. But I think that group is now in decline. I think it probably reached its high point in about 2007, 2008, when the issue was a live one in the vaccine court in Washington, D.C. But then in 2009, the special masters there. Most listeners probably wouldn't know that there's a special court in Washington which hears cases of alleged vaccine damage. And they carried out a very, very exhaustive inquiry into all of this and basically threw the whole thing out in February 2009. And I think since that time, the public controversy has been in decline. But what I think keeps it alive in my own mind and in my own journalism at the moment is what this controversy tells us about the integrity of science. Because if it could be that someone could publish a paper in a prestigious scientific journal that turns out to be completely untrue, what else could be in scientific journals? And what is being done to ensure that research which is being carried out and presented to the world, whether, you know, about any kind of subject, that it's actually true? Who speaks for it? And I think that's an issue which arises and which continues to concern me.
It's continued to concern you. Have you done anything about it? Have you looked into other kind of journals or different kind of studies, not just vaccines?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had a piece in the Sunday Times, when would it have been, about 6 weeks ago, on this subject of the issue of scientific fraud, looking at different kinds of areas. I mean, the primary focus has been in medical science, But we'd have to ask, you know, what about genetically modified crops? Who speaks for the veracity of data on that? Global warming, who speaks for that? How do we know that what is being published in these learned journals, which are then taken up by general media, how do we know that is actually true? Because unlike with journalism, if you're publishing in a newspaper and you say that a plane crashed and 500 people died and the pilot's name was, Fred Ziboski and so on and so forth, other people, other journalists are checking that and similarly looking into it and publishing on it. But when you get these scientific journals that say, well, we recruited 500 women of ideal body weight, aged between 33 and 41, who'd never taken the contraceptive pill, and we looked at them for we assessed their cardiovascular status or whatever. You don't know that those women even existed because it's all anonymized. And that was what happened with the Wakefield paper. There were 12 children in a study published in The Lancet, and the data was all anonymized. So how did you know? And it was only because we were able to instigate a disciplinary hearing in London that went on for, I think it was 217 days, which made it a longer trial than the trial of O.J. Simpson all those years ago, to investigate the actual status of those children. We were able to review the medical records in public and see that what had been published about them wasn't true. So, and it cost, I don't know what it cost, it must have cost about $8 or $9 million, this exercise, for 12 patients, what would happen in a study of an epidemiological study involving thousands of patients. So, that's really where my interest lies now.
Our next question comes from Pat Anderson with the La Crosse Tribune.
What drives science fraud?
I think very often it's a narrative, really. It's and the Wakefield narrative is an interesting one. You start with a researcher who gets an idea. They go down the road a little bit of trying to test that idea, and when what it is that they were trying to prove doesn't turn out quite right, they alter the data, expecting that at a later point they will prove the hypothesis. I think it can start from very commendable instincts, but then can become degenerate. I suppose when we've seen in journalism, there have been some quite celebrated frauds in journalism. You know, even at the New York Times had an appalling case where people under pressure start to fudge their data. I suppose you could say there's a quest for glory in some researchers. Some do it for money. But I think by and large, it's people who think they're going to get to the right answer. And in the meantime, they chisel.
What role does the media play, or how is the media's role changing, I guess, in science and science research?
The difficulty, I think, for journalists is that a science journalist has a number of problems. One of the problems is that science is not full of personalities. People like reading about people. They don't so much like reading about technical theories or abstract ideas. And I think that makes it hard for science journalists. I also think it's hard because the public, and this has been recognized since Aristotle's time, what gets an audience going is two things, fear or pity. And Aristotle said thousands of years ago, you know, if you want to get the crowds to come down and watch your play, base it on fear and pity. And the vaccine story, again, is a classic in the sense that you have those things in abundance. So science journalists have it hard. It's difficult as well because science is such a broad area. You might be an expert in medicine and know nothing about, interplanetary travel or something. You know, so all of these things are highly specialist. Medicine's particularly hard also because doctors earn so much money, and it's almost impossible to get them to work as journalists because journalists don't get the kind of cash that that a doctor would get. So there's a lot of problems in science journalism. And, certainly in the UK, there was a lot of sensationalising around the vaccine issue.
And what seems interesting, too, is the fact that you were able to get access to these medical records and different legal documents, which is not an easy task.
No, well, there were two things there. Firstly was that Dr. Wakefield sued me. And as a result of suing me, I was able to read medical records of the relevant children. but wasn't able to use them journalistically because he abandoned his lawsuit and paid our costs after, I think it was 2 years of litigation. So
when was this?
Oh, well, he abandoned the lawsuit in his last lawsuit in January 2007. That was his previous one. He then sued again, and that's just been thrown out. So we got to see medical records there, but couldn't use them because they were disclosed in the course of litigation. But then, as a result of there being a disciplinary hearing by the doctor's regulator, which focused very much on these 12 children, the records were all laid out in a public hearing.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our guest today is Brian Deer. He's an investigative journalist with the Sunday Times of London, and he is in La Crosse visiting the UWL campus, giving a talk, An Elaborate Fraud, the MMR Vaccine and Autism. Obviously, there are many families, many parents who feel very passionately about this. There are people out there who do believe that there is a link between vaccines and autism, and I'm sure many of them have addressed you over the years and talked with you about that. What do you say to them?
Well, firstly, I think you're slightly off the mark when you think there are many families. I don't think there are many families. I think a tiny number of people today think that there's any connection between vaccines and autism in any meaningful way in their lives. You know, if you were to do a public opinion survey, you might get what appears to be a significant number of people with concerns. But I don't think there's any substantial body of opinion in that area.
But they're passionate. The ones that do believe are passionate.
Well, yes, but then. There was a passionate group, which I think still exists to a certain extent, who argued that HIV was not the cause of AIDS. There's also a passionate group of people, equally small and irrelevant, who would say that the Nazis in World War II did not gas large numbers of Jewish people in concentration camps. They deny it. They say, well, it didn't happen. There are people who say that President Kennedy was assassinated as part of some kind of conspiracy, and people hold all kinds of strange views. They, you know, certainly in America today, you'd find people who hold strange views about anything. But so in the vaccine issue, I'm only aware of. I was actually looking today of how many websites you'd find currently discussing this issue, and I think really you're down to about one.
There were more than that was I was preparing for this interview.
Well, I'm not sure. Well, discussing
discussing your work, discussing the MMR vaccine, discussing other vaccines, vaccines containing mercury.
No, well, not current, not posting stuff contemporaneously. I mean, obviously, there's been hundreds of people, thousands of people have discussed this issue over the last 2 or 3 years. But I'm not aware of anybody talking about me. I'm aware of one group run by a man who worked for the Moonies. He worked for the Unification Church and got let go by them and started a blog. Well, you know, people can start blogs about anything. People can sit in their bedrooms and call themselves, you know, the International Vaccine Safety Council and start holding forth about, you know, the safety of children's vaccines. But that doesn't mean that they represent anything. I'm not aware of any consequential body of opinion. My writing, I'm not aware of any numbers of doctors or scientists writing in saying, well, what you're saying is not true or anything. I mean, I'm simply not aware of it.
So what do you say to families if they say, my child, symptoms of autism appeared after they had received an MMR vaccine or any other vaccine? Well, I mean, what do you say to them?
Well, the first thing I could say, I mean, if I was to be quite hard-nosed about it, I would say, well, as a journalist, I can tell you as an absolute fact that if I was to publish an article in the Sunday Times this weekend saying that a Dr. Schmeckelgruber in Switzerland believes that autism may be caused by Christian baptism, and he's not sure, but he thinks that it may be something to do with the marble in the fonts of some churches, you would find that that night there would be a significant number of parents who would start going through their child's record saying, yes, that's it. Tim was baptized on the 31st of March, and then on the 2nd, it was about the beginning of August, before we went on holiday, he stopped speaking, or he stopped listening to us, or what have you. And that was when it all began. That's right. That doctor's right. And they would write to Dr. Schmeichel-Gruber, and they would write to me. And if I was a good campaigning journalist, I would get their letters and their emails and make a story out of that. So that would be the hard-nosed response. Or children becoming autistic after a trip to the zoo, because we know that children go to the zoo, and after that, some significant number will go on to get developmental diagnoses. So you could take it from that point of view, or you could look at it in a more compassionate way, a more human way, and say, well, these parents are people who maybe at the time when they're perhaps their first child, the most important thing in their life, the focus of their life, they start to think, well, hang on a minute, Jimmy is not listening to us. Is it that he can't hear, or he's pulling away from us, he won't be cuddled, or he seems to be doing repetitive things or constantly looking at his fingers or something? And they then go on what I call the desperate quest. They go and speak to paediatricians. They go to perhaps or to a family doctor who says, well, children all develop in different ways. I'm sure it'll all be fine. And they reassure because they, you know, the paediatrician or the family doctors know what to do. That doesn't turn out to be right. The problem continues. The parent then goes perhaps to gets referred to a paediatric neurologist. Paediatric neurologists will you know, examine the child, might give a diagnosis. Well, a neurologist wouldn't give the diagnosis at that time. A developmental paediatrician might give a diagnosis, knowing that the diagnosis would not be fixed in time. They couldn't say how this child was going to be in a year's time, in 10 years' time, or as an adult. So they give a kind of very vague and generally quite optimistic view. And if the picture doesn't turn out the way the parents hope, and is obvious how the parents want the thing to turn out, some become bitter, some become confused, some become guilty. And when people come along, perhaps a doctor, perhaps this man, Dr. Wakefield, comes along and says, ah, it's all caused by vaccines, and it was a result of, you know, an evil drug company conspiracy to sell you vaccines, that your child has been injured. Some of these parents become very, very outraged and angry and bitter and hostile. Most don't, thankfully. Most really understand what's going on, talk to their doctors, and try to come to terms, as I think people have to try to do with misfortune in life. And they try and do the best for their child. They perhaps try and get any kind of treatments that are available. But some don't, and they become very bitter. And in very small numbers, they become abusive. Blaming even me. I mean, I now get blamed for their child's autism. I mean, how that can be, I don't know. But it's a very sad situation. But I try to maintain an attitude of compassion for them, because to see a child show signs of developmental issues must be devastating.
It's been almost a decade since your investigative report came out. Why do you think that this is still a topic? The idea that vaccines can cause autism?
I suppose lack of another one, really. I mean, in media terms, it's quite a cheap and cheerful story. You can put forward the proposition that vaccines cause autism. This creates fear. And by creating fear, media can sell products, even public radio, although it doesn't sell products in quite the same way as commercial media. And that's a relatively straightforward thing. And then what you get, and we've seen it not just in the MMR thing, but we've seen it in other areas of...
Right, like you hear it with the flu vaccine and,
yeah,
and others.
And then what happens is you get outbreaks of infectious disease because parents stop vaccinating, or some proportion of parents stop vaccinating. I came into the United States through Chicago last night, and above the immigration thing, there were announcements from the CDC saying, well, you know, measles is now a major issue around the world, and advising people to get vaccinated. So you then get, having destabilized vaccination rates, media can then say, well, look, there's the risk of measles. So again, you've got fear, and media again can sell media products off that, advertising and all the rest of it, circulation, audiences. So you, vaccines are really kind of ideal. So you've got the fear factor, but you've also got the pity factor because you've got mothers and their children in jeopardy. So it's a great story. I mean, looking at it as a journalist, it's a great story. I have to say, though, nothing would have made me prouder and more fulfilled in my life than to have discovered that vaccines cause autism, or to have been the journalist that brought to the world's attention to the fact that vaccines cause autism. Because if that was true, then there would be something really remarkable that could be done for children, because we'd begin to understand more about the enigma of autism. Nothing would have been more fulfilling. Nothing would have got me more prizes or got me more foreign travel or made me more money or, you know, got me on the network news more often than that. But also that overwhelming sense of having done something remarkable for children. Unfortunately, and I'd repeat that, unfortunately, all my inquiries show that there is no evidence that vaccines cause autism. No credible evidence at all. I feel that I've accomplished something because I came into journalism, because I believe, and I fundamentally believed this all my career, I believed it as a student and I believe it now, that in truth lies freedom. The truth is something that I've tried to get out in all of this. But it's not the truth that solves the enigma of autism.
Brian Deer is a reporter with the Sunday Times of London. A series of reports he did almost a decade ago helped discredit a medical report that claimed vaccines were responsible for causing autism in young children. Thanks to reporters Pauline Lee of News 8 and Pat Anderson of the La Crosse Tribune for helping ask questions. Brian Deer shared his story last month during a visit to UW-La Crosse. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Steve Roysom, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. In addition to Newsmakers, you'll find archived reports and special series produced by the La Crosse News Bureau. And if you'd like to comment on this week's Newsmakers or have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/lacrosse. Newsmakers is also on Facebook. Updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us at WPR Newsmakers on Facebook.